when you finish marking your songbooks, if you have a bookmark in your Bible, I'd ask you to put it in Hebrews chapter 10. And then after you do that, if you'll flip over, actually, I want to begin our study in Matthew chapter 17 this evening. So put your bookmark in Hebrews 10, and then we'll start in Matthew chapter 17. It's good to see you tonight. Mark's got our memory verse for the month on the board behind us from 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 7. If you want to say this with me, and again, I reiterate, I'm learning the first part of this too. So if I mess up, keep going because you can see it, and I don't have my Bible open. So 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, for I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" I want you to appreciate that concept of God looking at the heart. I want you to look over to Matthew chapter 17. And I want to kind of introduce what I want to talk about this evening with this contemplation. When Jesus comes down off of the Mount of Transfiguration, which is outside of Caesarea Philippi, Matthew tells us, Luke tells us also in Luke chapter 9, that Jesus comes down off the mountain and the next day comes into an adjoining village wherever the 9 disciples other than Peter, James, and John had stayed while Peter, James, and John and Jesus had gone up on the mountain. When he comes down off the mountain, he finds this multitude gathered. And they are surrounding the disciples. This is in Matthew chapter 17 somewhere in the vicinity of verse 13 or 14. And he finds this multitude, this large group of people around his remaining 9 apostles that are there. And please understand, this is late in Jesus' ministry, probably within the last year of Jesus' life. So Jesus has spent some time at this point with these men. He spent some time teaching the gospel. No one involved at this point in this circumstance is new. And a man comes up to Jesus and says, my son is demon-possessed. Luke says that he's epileptic. He shows signs of seizures. And the demon throws him into the fire. The demon tries to kill him. And the man asks Jesus if he would cast the demon out. And he makes the statement that he had brought this child, verse 16, to the disciples, but they couldn't cure him. And I want you to notice Jesus' reaction in verse 17. Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me." Have you stopped and considered what life must have been like for Jesus while he's on the earth? I mean, we have our conceptions of what life must have been like, and Jesus getting up every day and going about, probably if your views are kind of like mine, I see Jesus getting up, and almost as soon as he walks out, whatever door he's coming from, whoever home he's staying in, or even if he's staying out in the open, which I suspect he did some, when he gets up and starts moving around, suddenly there are people around him. My suspicion is when Jesus is in his personal ministry, in the last 3 years of his life, he's just around people all the time. In fact, we find several accounts where he slips off by himself just to have some time to pray. And the chances are pretty good that as he goes about the day-to-day affairs, he's fielding questions, he's teaching people, he's trying to take the time to talk to the apostles about this, that, and the other. They're going to this village, they're going to that village. People are pulling at him and tugging at him with regards to their demands. So people are sick, people want to hear the gospel, people have questions, people are tempting him, and life must have been pretty trying. I can only handle so much of being around folks, and that's about 5 minutes worth, and I'm ready to go off by myself. I can't imagine what life must have been like for Jesus. But I tell you, the thing that strikes me about that is that God looks at the heart. Which means that if Jesus was possessed of all of his divine attributes, other than his divine glory was upon the earth, if he had divine knowledge, and this is starting to get into the area where we're whittling a little on God's end of the stick, because I don't know everything that Jesus knew while he was on the earth. But I do believe he was God in the flesh. And so let's just for argument's sake say that Jesus understood and could see the hearts of the people around him. Luke tells us early in his gospel that Jesus knew what was in man and at times would not reveal his divine power to him. So all these people that are coming to Jesus, Jesus knew whether they were really sincere or not. Jesus knew if they were just after the food, if they just wanted to see the miracles, as some of them freely admitted. He knew who was testing him and who wasn't testing him. And what life must have been like when day in and day out, everyone you ran into, you knew exactly what was in their heart. When Bill made his comments at the table this morning, he made the observation that the Lord's Supper and the observation of it is a bittersweet ceremony, remembrance. There's a lot in the Bible that is of the nature of paradox, things that are opposite in nature. The Lord addresses, for instance, through Peter in 1st and 2nd Peter quite explicitly the concept of suffering and glory. And as you go through the Scripture and as you start to study the Bible, what you realize is that there are a lot of things about serving God that have an opposite aspect to them that you have to endure. Whoever wants to be greatest needs to be least. Whoever wants to be first should be last. The Lord uses those kinds of concepts regularly. And what life must have been like for Jesus living the ultimate experience of suffering and glory. He's God in the flesh, and yet he is constantly surrounded by people that he knows don't really care. I mean, we see glimpses of it in Matthew chapter 17, the passage I just read for you. Jesus is talking, I believe, about his apostles. Now, we don't stop and think about that when Jesus says, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long should I be with you?" And it's very easy to read that and think, well, he's talking about this man and all these multitudes of people that didn't believe. No, he's not. The apostles couldn't cast this demon out, and when they, in the next verse, in verse 19, come and ask Jesus, why couldn't we cast him out? Jesus said it was because of your unbelief. So who is the faithless, the unbelieving generation here? Well, it certainly includes Jesus' apostles. And his question is, how long am I going to have to put up with this? Now, I think that's an aspect of Jesus' nature that we don't stop and think about. As a man, Jesus had at times to be frustrated, at times to be terribly disappointed. He stands on Mount Olive, Mount Olivet, and he overlooks Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 23 and says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you wouldn't." And Jesus looks at that city of people and he knows what their hearts are and he knows what's going to happen to them. And how terrible that must have been for him. In John 6, when he feeds the 5,000, and they try to make him a king, and he leaves and he goes across the sea, same day that he walks on the water and saves the apostles and gets them all there the next day in John 6, and they're coming to Jesus, and he had this big discussion about Jesus being the bread of life, and he talks about giving him his flesh to eat and his blood to drink. And people just say, man, this is just too hard for me. And they start walking away. What must that have felt like when you are God in the flesh who has come to give your life for people and to watch them walk off? My suspicion is, Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 3 describes Jesus as a man of sorrows. My suspicion is that Jesus, while he understood and came to reveal the grandeur and the glory of God and hope and mercy and life and love and light and all those wonderful things, While all of that was very true, my suspicion is there were times when Jesus was, as a man, very, very frustrated. Now I want you to turn over to Hebrews chapter 10. The book of Hebrews, this is going to be our reading the last Sunday of the month, by the way. It'll be the first part of the book. But the book of Hebrews is written to Christians, folks like me and you. And these aren't new Christians. I know that because, for instance, if you go down into a little bit earlier in Hebrews chapter 10, just before the section that Bill read, in verse 32, the writer says, "Recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle." These people have been Christians for a while. And in fact, they've endured some difficulty in their faith. And what's happening to them in their life is something unlike anything we've experienced, although we may, before it's all said and done. They are being strongly urged to leave their faith. Now, the reason they're being urged to leave their faith is because, as the letter is entitled, they are Jewish people living in somewhere in the vicinity of Jerusalem, in Judea. And they are thus surrounded by the culture from whence they have come. That they used to be Jews by religion. They are still Jews by nationality. And all of the prejudices and all of the things that they've been taught all their life are still pulling on them. And things are getting hard in their life. Now, it does not appear at the time of this letter that they are suffering physical persecution, although there is some possibility. Later on in chapter 12, he's going to talk about the fact that you haven't yet resisted to blood. But nonetheless, these people are being pressured in ways that maybe we have some familiarity with. The culture is pushing on them. The culture is pulling them to not give their conviction to Jesus and to give their conviction and their time and their attention and their everything to what they've come from, to their old friends, to their old life, to the way things are done in a Jewish community. And the whole letter is written as an exercise in reason. And the rationale is, Christianity is better than anything than you can go back to, so don't go back. Until you get to this section. When you get to chapter 10, there is, over the next chapter and a half, a very powerful appeal to those who are frustrated, to those who understand the grandeur and the glory of heaven and all that awaits, all the promises. Remember, these people came out of Judaism, so their understanding of the promises and probably their appreciation of Christianity may well have superseded ours. We are not generally very strong Old Testament students, and we certainly didn't come out of a culture that was completely based upon the idea that a better time is coming, and a better king is coming, and a better kingdom is coming. And that's what these people have been looking for and raised their whole life. And now all of that has happened. And so there is an appreciation of the gospel probably far greater than what some of us have. They came out of an oppressive system where every day was marked by do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And now, while the demands of morality and character certainly are still the same, life wasn't any longer marked by the keeping of the commandments, but by the grace of God. And yet, you know, it had to be frustrating for these people when they got up every day and they were constantly being pulled. Now, I want to draw a couple of parallels before I look at a couple of these verses. There are a lot of things that pull us away from the Lord. And I think for Sunday night Christians, if you'll let me use this term, people who for the most part are really serious about what you're doing here, not just coming in and going and playing church. You really want to try to serve the Lord. There are certain frustrations and discouragements that come with service. We see heaven. We see the glory. We understand forgiveness. We know the promises. Those are the things that drive us. We understand we are to rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. But we also hopefully understand that Paul wrote the words of Philippians chapter 4 when there is discouragement going on in Philippi. And we understand the other side of that coin, don't we? We understand what it's like when people around us on a college campus, several of you are headed off to school, just finished school. We understand when we're the odd man out on a college campus, when everybody else lives a different way, when everybody looks at fundamental Christians as people who just not, you're not using your head, you're not thinking clear, there's something wrong with you, that you'd still buy in to that kind of medieval thinking. We understand what it's like to work in the business world where people are corrupt and we're trying not to be corrupt. We understand what it's like to try to raise our children to be moral and godly when a lot of people don't really care whether their children are moral or godly. We understand what it's like to be a part of a congregation where a lot of folks within the congregation really don't seem to care too much about whether we're really serving God or not. So we got the glory. We understand what's ahead of us, but we also understand the frustrations. That's why this section of Hebrews was written. For folks like us and folks like them that understood the grandeur and the glory, but also had to deal with the frustrations. And so I want to make a couple of observations from this section. And we're going to do a little bit of reading because the argumentation is pretty straightforward. But what I want you to appreciate is this reminder. I personally believe Paul wrote this letter. It is very Pauline in its argumentation. It's not definite, but that's what I think. And he certainly would have the background to write it. What I want you to appreciate as we read these sections is how the arguments address the problem. Very often we read the Bible, seems like we read it and we don't really understand it. We can't get a hold on it until somebody explains it to us. But this section, if we put it in the context of people who are dealing with discouragement and frustration and difficulty, then it makes a lot of sense. So I want to read, first of all, in chapter 10, beginning in verse 19. And I want to make this point about this section. We're going to read to the end of chapter 10 here. And I want to make this point about this section. That this is a reminder from Paul, first of all, in this section, that it is easy to become discouraged when you're trying to serve the Lord. And I want you to get this point. There is this pie-in-the-sky kind of mentality that some people have that says when you're a Christian, everything's wonderful all the time. No, it's not. And it wasn't for Jesus, and it wasn't for the apostles. We deal with all the garbage in life. We deal with our relatives dying. We deal with the demands on our times. We deal with seemingly futile efforts. We deal with people in the world and how we deal with life as Christians. And we're lying to ourselves if we think we get up every day and everything's wonderful. The future is wonderful. There's no question that that is true. We have all kinds of incentives to glory, but we still have to live with the garbage. So listen to what Paul says, first of all, to the Hebrew writer, in regards to becoming discouraged. He says, beginning in verse 19, "Therefore, brethren," and he's just been talking about the sacrifice of Christ and what it does for us. "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." Stop right there. Let me make an observation or two. This is very Old Testamentish language. And the suggestion that's being made, the instruction that's being made here is twofold. For those people who are being dissuaded from serving the Lord, who have forgotten what Jesus has done, the instruction is, first of all, you need to pull yourself closer to God. That's the point beginning in verse 19 through 22, when he says, we have boldness to enter the holiest. Under the old law, the tabernacle or the temple had an outer court, an inner court, and then the sanctuary. And the sanctuary had the holy place and the most holy place. And if you're familiar with this at all, most of the Jews could go into most of the courts except the innermost court that the priest could go in. And then the priest could only go into the holy place. And only when they're offering the sacrifice, they just couldn't wander in and out. They only went in there as they were conducting the work they were doing. But the most holy place was off limits. The high priest went in there once a year on the Day of Atonement. That was it. And the reason is, the most holy place, and Adam mentioned this morning, addressing some of the circumstances with David. And then in the Revelation class this morning, there is the picture in Revelation 15 of the judgment of God coming out of the holy place. That's where God resided. And nobody could go in there. And what the Hebrew writer is saying is, we can. We can go right up to God. We have access to the very throne of God Himself, he says, by the blood of Jesus. And we have to be bold enough when life is frustrating and life is discouraging. We have to be bold enough to take all that to God. Sometimes we use pithy little phrases to talk about pouring out our hearts to God, but that is exactly what the writer is saying. We have a new veil. It's not the old curtain that separated us. It is the veil of Jesus' flesh, and He died for us, and He rent that flesh so that we can walk in, and He is also our high priest, so we can speak to God. So in verse 22, draw near with a full assurance of faith. God is listening to us. And I'm going to tell you, when you're frustrated and discouraged, it is easy to forget that. When all life is beating up on you and you're watching the problems that you're having to deal with in your life, it is easy to forget that you can walk right up to the throne of God. And that comment is made actually three or four times in Hebrews. The Jews couldn't do that, but the Christians could. And then he says after that, verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. Not only do we go to God and draw closer to God, but we hold on. And you don't let go, and you don't let go for anything, no matter what the pressure is. No matter it is secularism or distraction or discouragement or culture or opposition, it really doesn't matter. You hold on, he says, because he who promised is holding on. He's faithful. And then in verse 24, and here's the kicker. You need to make sure you're about the service of other people. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I don't know how it is with you. I know how it is with me. When I get frustrated or discouraged, most of the time it is because I am just thinking about how it appears to me and what I'm dealing with and what I'm thinking and what I'm seeing and the futility of my work or the... You want to put your life into some perspective? You go try to encourage somebody else in their life. You go try to help somebody who's sitting with a loved one, sitting with a sister as she's dying. You go try to deal with some parents who are watching their children as their children leave the faith. You go deal with that kind of garbage a little bit. And that's the point he's making. You know, given all the blessings that we have, we need to draw closer to God, and we need to be about the business of stirring up love and good works in another. Don't become so selfishly obsessed that you forget one another. And by all means, beginning in verse 26, then, if we sin willfully, and what he's just said is, don't forsake each other. I know he's talking about the assembling of ourselves, but that's in the context of thinking about one another. If we sin willfully, if we just disregard each other, after we've received the knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries. Anyone who rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy, who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant with which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace? We know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. We better be forewarned about walking away from the Lord when things are hard. Because when we do, we walk away from the only hope that we have. Which leads to the very end, and Bill's already read this for us. And the point he goes on to make here is we need to have some confidence in what God's got in store for us. Recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle of sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. You had compassion on me in my chains. You joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. The point he's just made is you've gone through stuff like this before and you came out okay, and you did exactly what I'm telling you to do now. You looked at me and you helped me and you endured it and you came out through it. So, therefore, do not cast away your confidence that has great reward. You have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just will live by his faith. If anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. We are not of those who draw back to destruction, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. It's easy to become discouraged. This is the section to remember. Now I want you to look at chapter 11 very quickly. I'm not going to read all of it because it is very long. But I want to make a second observation that I think is pertinent to the subject at hand. And the argument that is now made is the faith that you have. And that's what he's just mentioned in verse 39. We are not the people who draw back. That's not us. We're the people who keep our faith. And then he's going to go on and say, essentially, faith is very practical and it's very powerful. And I want to reiterate something I made a comment I made a couple of weeks ago in a lesson. We need to understand that faith, biblical faith, goes far beyond just the concept of believing that Jesus is the Son of God. That is the cornerstone of faith. It is the fundamental truth upon which all of our trust is built. But trust goes beyond just the idea that if I am baptized because I am penitent and because of my trust in God, that God's going to forgive my sins. There's just much more to it than that. It is this concept that I'm going to put my trust in the way that God tells me to live and what God has said about the world and where I came from and where I'm going and who I am and why I'm here and what's going to happen. I'm going to trust all of that. My life is going to be a testimony to the choice I have made to trust God. And the point that is being made is that's very practical and very powerful, and it's very well grounded. We are living in an age where we are very often criticized, even to the point of ridicule, because we trust God. Because the culture is becoming more secular, and we're encouraged more and more to put our confidence in what science is telling us. And science says this and science says that. And I'm not opposed to science. I don't think a Christian ought to be opposed to science. I just think we need to keep it in balance. Science doesn't answer everything. No matter what scientists tell us about the Big Bang and the origin, that's a faith-based system. There are aspects of the Big Bang theory that have to be taken upon faith, and there's no evidence of it. And they don't want you to understand that. We believe in a personal creator, in a power that existed eternally. The Big Bang theory says that there was matter and there was energy that existed eternally. There's still an eternal something. And yet science wants to make us feel like that somehow or the other we're less than rational beings. We don't use our mind. We're just superstitious simpletons. We're not. And that's the point that is made here. It is interesting to me that he makes the argument of the practical power of what we have chosen to believe. Faith, he says, is the substance, what stands under the things we hope for. And he's just mentioned that we are those who hope for the Lord coming back again. That's what we're looking for. Faith is what stands under that hope. And it is the evidence of the things that we can't see. He illustrates this actually in verse 3 when he says, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. The next time somebody asks you, how do you know God created everything? The right answer is, because I believe that. And they're going to, wait a minute, how do you know that? And the answer again should be, because I believe that. It is belief that supplies the argument. I've chosen to believe God. I've chosen to believe in God. Everything in my life revolves around, that is the choice I have made. To me, it makes the most sense in this world. And as one who believes in God, what God has said is, He created everything from nothing. That's what the Hebrew writer says. By faith we understand the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so the things that are seen were not made by the things that are visible. God took nothing and created something. And people go, that's ludicrous. Not if God's God. It's not any more ludicrous than to think that eternal matter, that we don't know where it came from, and eternal energy, that we don't know where it came from, somehow or the other involved itself in some cosmic accident and blew up and created the ordered universe as it stands. And you're going to tell me that I don't make sense? It is our trust in God that supplies the answers to this life. It helps us to understand why things happen. It helps us to understand where we're going and where we have been. It is a very powerful, well-grounded, practical aspect of life. And all of Hebrews chapter 11 is just intended to prove that. Have you ever wondered why Hebrews 11 is written? All these people that acted in faith. He's not making an argument for he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. You know what the Hebrew writer is saying? If you live your life trusting in God, you are a part of a group of people who have done some remarkable things and who have made some tremendous sacrifices and who have lived very peculiar lives. Look at all these people who live the way they live just because they trusted in God. Abel offered a sacrifice. Enoch was translated because he walked with God. Noah built a big old boat. Abraham left his country and his family and wandered off, spent all of his life wandering around in tents, never would settle down in a city. Sarah had a child when she was too old and was barren. Isaac, Jacob, Moses. Moses' parents stuck him. Now get this. Now just think about this. The order of Pharaoh was, take your male children, chunk them in the river. They're going to die. So what did Moses' parents do? They build a little basket and they send him off in the river. What do you think is going to happen if you put a kid in a basket and push him off in a river? That somehow or the other that he's going to get up and paddle along until he goes off and builds a campfire and makes himself a house? And you know why they did that? Because they trusted that God was going to take care of that kid. They did some remarkable things, some crazy things. Moses, as he got older, forsook being in Pharaoh's house. They sprinkled blood on their doorposts because they thought God was going to come kill everybody one night. They marched off and left Egypt and headed right for a body of water that they couldn't get across. Why are you going to do that? When they got to Jericho years later, they get up 7 days in a row, get everybody in their battle gear, go out, march around the town, and go back home. Don't you think the citizens of Jericho thought this is the craziest bunch of folks I've ever seen? They have spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness and their brains are fried. These people did remarkable things, peculiar things, because God told them to. Purely because they trusted it. And you know what happened as a result of that? God did some remarkable things. He translated Enoch. He gave Abraham, who had no children, made him a great nation. He gave Sarah a child when she was 90 years old and barren. He caused the walls of Jericho to fall down, caused the Red Sea to part. He did come on the night of the Passover and kill all of those people. All of these things God did just because these people trusted Him. And the point that's made at the very end of Hebrews chapter 11 is, all these, verse 39, all these having obtained a good testimony through faith did not receive the promise. Now some of them received some of the promises they were given. Enoch was translated, the walls of Jericho fell down, etc. But a lot of these people, they didn't get whatever it was God had promised them. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob didn't. In fact, probably the most well-known section of the chapter, beginning in verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and they were assured of them, and they embraced them, and they confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth, because they were looking for a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Well, what's the point of all this? Well, history illustrates that if we'll just not lose our faith when we get frustrated and discouraged, that we are not of those who draw back to perdition. We are of those who believe to the salvation of our souls. Why? Because we trust God. And what happens here doesn't really matter in that regard. Whatever is frustrating us, whatever is discouraging us, whatever is pressuring us, it really doesn't matter. Because the promise is not here. Which leads to the point and the last observation in chapter 12 when he says, therefore we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider Him who endured such hostility from sinners against yourself, lest you become wearied and discouraged in yourselves. This great cloud of witnesses are all these people, and the picture is Enoch and Abel and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Moses and Rahab and Joseph and all these people he's just mentioned. They're all watching. Now, I don't know if they really are. I don't know if there is a way that those who have gone before can see what's happening in this world. If they can, they're watching, and the picture is the picture that would have been seen by a marathon runner as he runs into the stadium at the end of the marathon. After 26 miles, why some of you crazy people do this is beyond me. But after that, you know what's the best thing in the world that can happen to you? A whole bunch of people standing up and saying, you're nearly there, you can finish this. That's the picture. And he says, that's what we have. All these people, he mentions all of them. The Bible characters we learn about, you little kids, the reason you learn about these Bible characters is because they are your motivation. They're the ones cheering for you. And it's not just the Bible characters. It's my papa and mama. And my papa Joe and my grandma. And Wilson Usry. And Ed Owen and James Cope. And Phil Roberts and Marty Pickup. And Joyce Day, and Jim Maness, and Leighton O'Banion, and all these people that have gone before us who are now gone, but who lived lives just because they believed in God. So the instruction is, you just get up every day and you go do your running. You run the race, and you endure. That's not really the answer I'd like to have. You know what I want when I get frustrated and discouraged? I want the problem fixed. You know what I like to see? I don't have many. James, you know how many people are on the roll right now? 150, maybe? 140, 150? 159 people that constitute the regular, quote-unquote, members and families of this congregation. You want to know what I want? I want 159 people here at every service. And I keep thinking, man, if I could get that, I would never be discouraged. Yeah, I would. But it'd be a good start. Do you know what God says? You just endure it. And you get up every day and you look at Jesus, knowing that Jesus came down off that mountain after 2 years of teaching those apostles and found out that they couldn't cast out a demon because they didn't believe enough. And he had to say, man, how long do I have to bear with you guys? But he did bear with them. And that's who we look to. Now, I don't know if this helps you. This lesson is very cathartic for me because right now I'm really frustrated. Can you tell? But, folks, we're not fighting a lost cause here. Now, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There are folks that need to straighten up and start getting to work. I'm one of them. But we're not the first people to deal with this kind of stuff. And we won't be the last as long as the earth stands. And it is imperative that we use the Bible the way the Bible is intended to be used. That's why Hebrews 10 and 11 and 12 were written. Because folks just like us, we're dealing with the stuff just like us. And so God says, here, you draw near to me. You don't forget your salvation. You go encourage and you help one another. You remember the practical value of your faith, and then you get up every day and you deal with it. And just keep on serving. So, if you find yourself in those circumstances, let me make a suggestion to you. Sit down, turn off everything, and read Hebrews 10, 11, and 12, and then get up and go serve the Lord. If you're subject to the invitation tonight, we invite your response while we stand and sing.